Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, November 10th, 2022, in the year-long ongoing series of the history of the discovery of my work. And this week, I want to start out, I'm not going to take the whole show on this, but it's important to understand my discovery that Planet X, the one, the real one that everybody was really wanted to know about, the singularity Planet X, because there are many Planet X objects. Not all of them. There's kind of wild idea that every Planet X object is going to hit Earth. Things that affect Earth are really extremely rare, but there's a lot of stuff in outer space. So statistically, for something to come as close to Earth as Venus did, for example, is really a rare item, especially with Venus becoming one of the major planets. A very rare item, and especially to have this happen in historical times. But now we're talking about a Planet X object that was seen in the past that was recurring because Venus became a planet. It's not there to come back and cause future harm to Earth. So there's a lot of confusion with that, a lot of confusion with what the Mayans were talking about, because they were dealing with Venus. Venus the comet, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. That was Venus. That's why the central, platform in Chichen Itza, which is dedicated to Quetzalcoatl, is of Venus. It's in honor of Venus. It's not the sun. It's not the moon. It's not Jupiter. It's not anything else but Venus. Okay, so at any rate, back to the idea that Planet X, the real one that Harrington discovered, the one that NASA contracted the Naval Observatory, the one that they had been looking for since the Herschels first discovered Uranus back in the 1700s, in the late 1700s, and then Neptune in the early 1800s. There's the search for Planet X had been going on. It was constantly. Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto in a search while looking for Planet X, and then almost immediately discovered that that was not the object they were looking for. But the identification using my work that went back, and I was the only one that did this. And so, of course, I have to pat myself on the back a little bit for this. But I want to talk about the importance of this discovery that was known about in the intelligence communities. And nobody else put this together. Nobody else. I had an inkling about Hale-Bopp. And here is what I actually thought during the time that Hale-Bopp was the precursor. Because for example, in Hopi legends, they talk about the blue Kachina and the red Kachina, and these refer to comets, big comets, ones that did devastation to Earth. And so when Hale-Bopp came in, I thought, you know, that's the precursor, that's the blue Kachina. In fact, the Hopis called it the blue Kachina. That was their name for it, which would indicate that there was another bigger one coming in after it. And so I had then the Harrington expedition where I literally went to South America. I did not go to New Zealand like Harrington did. I went to South America, which actually extends farther south to Patagonia, with the similar equipment that Harrington had. And I looked for that follow-on object, which should have been very obvious at that time, and I found nothing. There was nothing there. And so that led me to the conclusion that Hale-Bopp was what Harrington was looking for, and also it had the same orbital. It was in the same part of the sky. It's what Harrington determined was Planet X. So now we narrow it down and find out that no, there was not another object coming in. There was not a red Kachina. And Lord knows there could still be something out there that is so far away, maybe 100 years away. But remember, things move very slowly out there. When Harrington discovered in 1991, finally discovered the Planet X object with its companion, clearly he would have seen the companion and then was able to determine its mass. And that's what set the frenzy. If this would have been just a little object like a little teeny comet nucleus or even something the size of Pluto, there would not have been the frenzy going on because of the size, the size of the mass of this Planet X object being many times the mass of Earth, and then being on a near direct collision course with Earth. And then it was modified by orbital change, a perturbation that occurred with an interaction with Jupiter. But that was not the big change. The big change came from the tail drag. And so at any rate, to understand that Hale-Bopp was Planet X is a huge discovery. And so that is in my book, Planet X, Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. And that was published a number of years ago, but it really lays out the entire history and goes through the whole issue with Harrington, Tom Van Flandern, impetus for Tom Van Flandern pushing Harrington to look at this, NASA then funding it. We have the NASA contract numbers, which was literally called the search for Planet X, Harrington discovering it, and then all of a sudden, completely unexpected, it turns into this giant comet, which proves unequivocally what Velikovsky was talking about, the ancient observations that comets become planets and planets can become comets. It's this amazing amount of corroboration. And of course, my work is central to this because in the 1979-81 period when I, went about publishing this material, and of course had the roadblocks put in front of me, I had identified this whole issue, the physics that went along with it, and the mechanisms by which planets would discharge the solar capacitor. Now, imagine if I had not discovered this. This would go through history with the world completely oblivious to this amazing fact. And the intelligence agencies, I don't think they're intelligence, that's what they call them. They're really not. They're really stupid people. Would have pulled off one of the biggest con jobs in the history of mankind. These are events. It's so important to understand these past events and connect them to the future, because in the future, these events will happen again. And we're told that by the prophets. We're told that by people that, in ancient times that talk about this. And back to the Egyptian priest cults, to Christ, who had a tremendous schooling in history, of course, probably a lot more than most people, than, people like Joseph of Arimathea, and the Colbran, which is the follow-up, the library, the bits and pieces that we have, remnants of today, of Joseph of Arimathea's library. But in the modern world, there has been such an effort to squelch anything like this, the complete cover-up of Velikovsky. And, the charlatans which surrounded the whole Velikovsky issue, who are still out there pounding the pavement today and really obfuscating the whole issue, etc. And so if it weren't for my work pinpointing all of these factors, the science part of it, the fact that comets can be large, just a small fact like that, which is, and then that the comets become larger, become planets, and, the big ones, and the differentiation between big and small and medium-sized comets, and how they physically act differently, because there's a threshold where the gravitational field, once the nucleus of a comet gets big enough, it can gravitationally maintain that material that's coming in. The small comets don't. They have this crusted material, like a tar-like material on them, that's made up of the materials that are brought in during the comet process, drawn in towards the nucleus, and there's an exchange. A lot of it gets baked off, a lot of it gets baked onto the nucleus, and but they really don't grow. These are not things that are going to easily form into planets. They're not going to grow to that size. So at any rate, it's so important to understand this, because the scientific community really does I have to give them credit. They do a tremendous job of getting the really incorrect science out to the public, just completely whitewashing the entire media with the glossy magazines, Astronomy or Science magazine, which is kind of semi-professional and is read by a lot of people in the general public, and they're thinking they are getting the real science. And the complete whitewashing that comes out of NASA, which is tier two science, etc. So to be able to pick apart all of this disinformation and put down the real story is a major, major accomplishment. And like I say, there's nobody else on the planet, literally, that could have done this. And so I think it's important just to point this out. The importance of my discovery that Planet X, the object that Harrington was looking for, the thing that Sitchin talked about, and of course Sitchin talked about the 3,600-year orbit. Of course, that was not correct. It was 4,250 years when Harrington finally discovered it in 1991. The Sitchin interview happened in 1986, and that's one of the more promulgated misconceptions about Planet X. And then, of course, like I said, the idea that every time it comes back, it affects Earth is ludicrous, because when you have two objects, Earth is in its orbit around the sun, it's moving. Planet X, the Hale-Bopp object, which has left the solar system, it'll be back in another about 2,500 years, has its orbit, and the probability that they're somehow going to cross paths each time in proximity, very, very small probability. We don't have an estimate right now of where it's going to be when it comes back, but it will be crossing Earth's orbit again. And will Earth be in that place in its orbit when it comes back? How much more energy, how much more of its orbit will be lost by Hale-Bopp before it gets back to Earth's orbit, where it crosses through the plane of the planets again? We don't know. These are things that, because these properties really have never been studied, and throughout history there have been very big comets, I'm sure some of them with nuclei that are at least as big as Earth, but nobody's ever been able to study this. NASA must have some data that I could go in and look at to determine what the real tail drag, how much was it, how much material was being drawn in every day, etc. What were the orbital dynamics of the tail material to begin with? All of these factors contribute to the change in orbit based on tail drag. But we don't really have that information, and you cannot solve these from simply a theoretical point of view. In the appendix of my 3-part comet paper, which is literally in the appendix of my Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book, I talk about doing a simulation that it took the planet, the comet Venus, after it encountered Earth, it probably took a period of about 600 years to nestle into its current orbit. And so, and that's due to tail drag. And so the ancients followed this. The next year it came around, or the next whatever it was. Yeah, next, it could have been 10 to 15 years. We don't know. But the next time Earth and Venus came around, it came. Venus came not so quite so close to Earth. And then when they encountered again, Venus was not quite so close. And so this would have been, for example, in the 40-year period when the Israelites were wandering in the desert. And they saw this thing coming again, and it didn't come quite as close. And then the next time again, and it just faded into history. And, of course, it probably was not encountering Earth as much. We may have gone through some rainy periods where the Earth passed through the comet tail, a very sparse comet tail, for example. We don't know. We don't have written history during those years. It was really a dark period after that second interface with Venus. But I think there's a lot of work being done today to understand that, yes, in fact, we did have a pole shift. And there again, when you look at the misinformation campaigns, it was full of information or misinformation about pole shifts, that somehow Planet X magnetic field would cause a pole shift. Well, magnetic fields are not going to cause pole shifts. The pole shift is caused by physical gravitational waves, and that's where the major pole shift comes from. And of course, the material that is in Earth's mantle is solidified iron and nickel, and there's a significant magnetic field there, but it's in very isolated locations in Earth's mantle. And so it's not going to be a principal factor in the pole shift. The pole shift is primarily, and I talk about this in my book, my pamphlet, the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. I talk about the pole shift and the physical mechanism, and so very important. But then again, back to this idea that the real Planet X object was the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. Very important. Okay, so on to the next topic. I want to combine a number of comet discoveries that I made here relative to specific comets. And I've talked about these before, but I want to put them together because of these predictions that I made. Two in particular, Comet Lee, which was the 1999 comet. That was the one where in May I predicted that on September 6th there would be a crescendo of storms, which in fact there were, and I told the story about how everybody was anticipating this, and they a couple days before that they said, there's not enough time for all this storm activity to develop. And then the laughing started the day before. Nothing's going on. The world is calm as a kitten. And at midnight, it broke. And there were over 60 major storms around the equator, many hurricanes. And as I said, the silence was deafening coming from the trolls and the critics. And after that, they pretty much shut up. They knew that I had this uncanny ability to make these predictions. But it happened again around the year 2007, and October. This was a fall comet. And because of the alignment of this comet, now Comet Holmes had been around in the solar system previously. And something that I noticed there, there were comets that had recurring alignments with the planets, and so Comet Holmes had a history of this. But anyway, I realized that it would have a three-way alignment with the planets, Mercury, Venus, and Mars. And the Mars alignment was very close to exact. Now, these are electrical alignments. They're not they're lineal alignments, but it also depends on the way the solar wind comes out. But at any rate, on a given day, I made the prediction that Comet Holmes would explode into brightness. which it did. In fact, I was exactly right on. And of course, it caught NASA completely by surprise, where they had no idea that, you know, because they thought comets are dirty snowballs, there should be nothing related to an electrical planetary alignment, which they don't believe in because they don't know about it. And in fact, Comet Holmes became visible to the point where it was literally as large as the full moon in the night sky. And you could go out and look up in the sky and see it, literally a big blotch of kind of a greenish-yellow color up in the night sky. So a very important prediction, and the NASA explanation was that an asteroid must have hit it, because it was in the asteroid belt. It was out in the asteroid belt. But they, you know, such a ludicrous comment, a ludicrous concept that somehow an asteroid hit this and it explodes into this big circular comet. Now, also, I related this at the time to my theoretical work talking about the circle of equal force. And when you look at the photos of the comet, you can see the rays of the tail coming in that correspond with the lines of the that are set up, the combination of force lines between the solar electric field and the cometary electric field, and they combine into this comet shape. And also the same was true when Hale-Bopp was photographed with a Swan filter. It had between 14 and 17 tails, and they were all bundles of water. These were water tails. And flailing around, it looked like, with time-lapse photography, it looked like a kind of like a hydra, a snake's head with these snake fibers or turbulent, like legs on an octopus, I think would be the closest analogy, flailing around out there daily. And also you could see the sunward activity. Okay, in around 2004, there was a comet called Comet Bradfield. Now, this was a comet that approached the sun, and just as it was becoming apparent in the field of view of the SOHO satellite, the satellite that observes the sun constantly, they shut down the feeds. And of course, what Comet Bradfield was doing was giving us a perfect light show of the sunward activity, the sunward side activity, and the sunward spike. And so, that, you know, clear indication that the NASA people knew exactly what was going on, that my work was correct, and they made every effort to squelch any data that would be obvious to the public. Another comet called C2012S1 ISON, it was one of the automated search discovered comets. I'm going to talk about a few comets here that had tremendous amounts of disinformation associated with them. And so what they did is they created controlled opposition. And these were like nutcase people in the on the internet that made the claims, oh, this was Planet X, truly Planet X, and it was going to just insanity. We'll just put it that way. It's not worth repeating. But of course, on any of these occasions, they would try and drag me into the fray, and to try and muddy up my name. So this was one of them, and of course, I've withstood so many of these throughout the history of my work that it was just another event for me. And of course, I did get some mileage out of this because I was able to make predictions. This particular comet came very close to the sun, about 2 million miles, which is about 8 lunar distances, very, very close to the sun. And of course, it managed to come around the other side of the sun relatively unscathed. In fact, it was bigger when it came around the sun. And of course, the idea was that the sun is so hot, it's going to burn up this little snowball and there's no chance for survival. But of course, it survived quite well. it passed around the sun and eventually made its way out of the solar system. But there again, like I say, they take these opportunities to try and drag the public into really spurious topics, like, say, Planet X-related topics, and then, as I said, create disinformation, controlled opposition, and then create this big stir, and then when nothing happens, then they go, see the crazy Planet X people out there again. Okay, talking about a different comet now, which was called Comet Elenin. And there was just a rage, absolute rage of misinformation coming out on the internet and predictions, wild predictions, and of course trying to drag my name into the midst of all of this. And as in typical fashion, I was the one that was the sane voice in this entire charade, saying that no, there's nothing with this comet. There's no need for fear, etc. One thing that did happen, which was very interesting, is as this comet got closer to the sun, it went what I call Phoenix. Now, if you've ever seen a picture of the Phoenix, the bird, in the sky that is typified in the American Southwest, it looks like a bird. It's like got a head, looks like kind of like a hawk, but with swept back, not swept back wings, but kind of rounded wings. Let's just put it that way. And if you've ever seen, like, a falcon in flight when it's diving, and it takes its wings and it lays them back along its side, it would be something like that, except more rounded. And the ancient drawings of the Phoenix are very specific. And Comet Elenin, when it got close to the sun, went Phoenix. It went into that exact same shape and was a yellowish color. And the Phoenix is typically typified by a yellowish color. So the interesting thing here is they drew attention to this comet, which was otherwise a nothing comet, trying to make such a big deal out of it. But when it went Phoenix, it really is something that a little dirty snowball just cannot do. And it's one of the predicted shapes from the plasma discharge comet model. And remember I told the story about the time I was in Quintana Roo in Mexico as a young person. I was standing in this little hut, and the quetzal bird, which was roosting in this woman's little shed, a Lacandon Indian woman, flew directly over my head, and it has on the bottom the signature features of the plumage on the bottom of the quetzal bird, which of course is a bird of paradise, long flowing tail feathers, but the bottom signature of the plumage is the same shape as the Phoenix, which is very interesting because that is the representation of the Mayans for Quetzalcoatl, which is the comet Venus. And so Venus would have had many different forms. They said Venus had as many as 14 tails at one time. And so depending on the vantage point that you would have from Earth on this, on comet Venus, for example, you would get a different image of what it looked like. But back to comet Elenin. Elenin went Phoenix, and it was, I'm sure I have photos of this on my webpage, of the Phoenix and of Comet Elenin. And when you see this, it's just an amazing similarity. And of course, the ignorant disinformation crew brought all this into attention to the comet, and then it does something like that, goes into a historic form that we know about from indigenous people in the American Southwest, obviously referring to the comet. And what's important is what the tale of the Phoenix, the mythology of the Phoenix in the American Southwest, that it destroys Earth. It burns it to ashes. And if you remember, out of the ashes rises the Phoenix. and the earth then rebuilds itself. Very much like the Kolbrun, just like everything else we know from the ancient legends, that comets are the ones that cause the great earth destruction. So very interesting. Comet Elenin, another comet which caused a tremendous amount of internet activity, disinformation, and which once again threw egg all over the face of the disinformation crew. Okay, next I want to talk about the Amateur Astro Project that I initiated in 2004. And what happened here is there were two comets, interestingly enough, came together in the sky at the same time and at a relative position where we were looking broadside, not at one, but at two comets. Very interesting, because these were very different comets, and I'll give their designations here. It was a C2002T7, and then there was another comet, C2001Q4. So these are completely different comets, but they end up in the same portion of the sky at the same time in a broadside configuration. So this is like an opportunity that is just amazing, too good to be true. And there's a window of opportunity, and it's a time when there's very little lunar activity. And so I'll give the dates here just to be specific, looking at my notes here. So it's between April 29th and May 6th for the C2002T7 comet. And for the C2001Q4 comet, May 11th and 15th after sundown. So I give very specific times in the morning. One is in the morning sky, one is in the evening sky, for people in a northern latitude, and looking for the sunward spike. Now, this is a time when they're crossing the ecliptic, and now another study I'll talk about in a few minutes here has to do with comets that were unusual brightening comets. That's a study that I did. And I realized that these comets were having planetary interactions. And this is goes back through history, back into the 1800s even, where then astronomers would try and imagine that, oh, maybe an asteroid hit it, or what was really going on. And like these two comets, what would happen is as they would come up through the ecliptic, the plane of the planets, they would also have a planetary electrical alignment. And some of them were quite complicated with many planets involved. Very interesting timing, but with so many things flying around in outer space, I guess you would expect statistically that it would happen on occasion. But these two particular comets that I'm talking about, this is the year 2004, the spring of the year, and so I generated interest on an international level for amateurs around the world to get their equipment ready, and I gave them very specific times when to take the pictures, and the point was that at this point of crossing the ecliptic and being relatively near the sun, this would be a time when they would develop a sunward spike, and I wanted to get pictures. Because if you're looking at a broadside view of the comet, in other words, you're looking literally like the side of a ship, you're looking at the side of the comet, and then if they develop sunward spikes, which they were very likely to do during these very specific time frames, then that would be conclusive evidence disproving the baloney argument that these so-called anti-tails are actually the standard garbage argument, was that they were optical illusions, that they were really tails pointing away from the sun, but because of their geometry, somehow we were seeing one. And this argument first came about with the comet Aaron-Rowland, and was it 1957, I believe, which developed a very intense sunward spike. And the astronomers just didn't know what to do about this because it was a comet that was visible to the naked eye, and very bright. And so they had to come up with a story. And actually, a woman astronomer came up with this bogus story that's just an optical illusion. It's really not a sunward spike or a sunward activity. And so anyway, that held for a little while, but then I said, wait a minute. There has to be occurrences of comets where we will see them broadside. And so that's what I was looking for. And with this pair of comets, and interestingly enough, it happened around the same time, late April, early May of 2004. So I wrote up a description of this. I posted it on my webpage, and I sent it around to amateur astronomy groups. And so I started to get a very good return because, you know, amateur astronomers, they love something to be part of a study, etc. I even gave them the time of time exposures, the time to and to take a series of photos for 1 second, 2 seconds, 4 seconds, 10 seconds, 15, 30 seconds, and up to 5 minute time exposures. And the idea being that as you took the longer time exposures, somewhere in there you would get a balance between not too much light coming from the comet and enough light coming from the sunward spike where you could actually capture it and then see it as you had longer and longer exposures, you would see it in all of the exposures and then have amateurs sending this data in from around the world. Well, everybody, this project got completely hijacked. NASA came in and they just hacked my email account so that nobody could email me nor could they receive emails from me. Then they set up their own worldwide observation of these comets, collecting photos that should have been coming to me, and then basically took over my project by interfering, getting in the way between me and the amateur astronomers. So this is 2004. So clearly they do not want amateur astronomers to understand this. I did a project recently also where there was a comet recently that had a very similar situation. And it was discovered by an astronomer, professional astronomer with an automated search engine. It was called Comet Leonard. And I was on many radio shows talking about this because it had a direct path to the planet Venus. In fact, it came so close to Venus that physically you couldn't see the difference between the comet and the planet. And I said, this is going to cause the comet to flare up, and it's going to cause Venus, the planet, to flare up and leave Venus with a comet tail. And it actually did that. It actually did. And these astronomers, after I made the prediction and after they realized that I was right, hid the data. And of course, they were taking photographs, and we know they had almost every instrument possible trained on this. And, of course, as typically happens, the NASA had one of the stereo, these are solar observatories that are out in outer space, actually shift directions to look at the comet when it came by Venus. That's how intent they were at trying to get observations. And the only reason that came out was because someone let it out by accident. But they were collecting all of this data, which proved conclusively that comets are certainly not dirty snowballs and that the comet could excite the planet Venus to turn back into a comet, which it did, which it literally did. And someone sent me finally the link to that satellite, to the stereo satellite with the footage. A little piece of footage showing the comet passing directly by Venus, exciting Venus, and then Venus turning into a comet. But of course, that never made it to the public eye. The public is never going to see that. So anyway, hundreds of incidents with comets have passed, over the decades throughout my career, and each one more bizarre than the other. The very strange thing is why we already know why. I've already talked about that. The issue of the world controllers, that they believe that that's their secret information, but they're so worried about the control aspect of people in general understand what comets are and the potential for large comets, and that would take away the power from the focus on their power that people have, the next presidential election, the mortgage payment, whatever it is, all of the things that you consider major newsworthy items today really have no significance when it comes to something that could come by Earth and destroy Earth or send it back to the cave ages. And so it's the one thing they just hold on to for dear life. But what is truly amazing is that the scientists, or so-called scientists, that are involved in this are just so confused. It's like there's some kind of drug in the water at NASA facilities. And, one might consider that there's a conspiracy or something like that. But no, these people really believe things that could not possibly be true. It's called the professor syndrome. And it's hard to see when, it's hard to imagine, but I've been in so many of these situations where I'm talking to these people, like maybe at an American Geophysical Union meeting where you're talking to lots of people. And at a certain point, they get this glazed over look in their eyes, and they disconnect. And this is what Tier 2 science is all about. It is a kind of a religion. It's a religious situation, literally. And the one thing about religions, which is different than spirituality, is that a religion gives you a set structure that you have to adhere to. And they take on if you look at the religious mantras around the world, they take on a form of their own, and the people adhere to these, and that's what astronomy is. There's just no other way around it. And you take people like, say, Carl Sagan, who truly believed that he was the smartest man in the world, and that what he said was just golden and true, when almost literally everything he said couldn't possibly be true at all and was known about in his time. That's what was so frustrating for me when I was at Cornell, was dealing with the people. And then there were people who were open and I could talk to, but only in private. But this glazed over look, or this just refusal to acknowledge anything but their current belief system. And of course, this is the ivory tower syndrome. But you would imagine that someday this mold would be broken. But the only way it's going to be broken is when the populace just wakes up, and when it comes to so many other issues, they just say enough is enough. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'm going to talk about my weather work and the whole construct that weather primarily is driven by electric fields in the atmosphere, and the primary electric field is the vertical electric field. The outside of Earth's ionosphere, there's 17 local electrical batteries. But the one primary one that drives our weather systems is the ionosphere to ground capacitor. And this is fueled. This is a complicated capacitor. Most capacitors have two plates, a positive plate and a negative plate. And they're parallel, and the physics regarding these are fairly simple. But in the Earth's atmosphere, you have bands of ions going in one direction, then you have bands of electrons going in the other direction, and these create magnetic fields and they're coupled together. And so the vertical electric field is complicated. It's very complicated, and there are cross batteries between these rotating current sheets. And as I said before, there are five of them on Earth. On Jupiter, there are 13. Many, many more bands, co-rotating or counter-rotating bands, of which the red spot sits in one. And you can see it as it's moving backwards relative to the other two bands. You can see it interacting with different storm systems, etc. Little teeny red spots, and sometimes they're blue and orange and different colors. But in Earth's atmosphere, let's take a look at storms like hurricanes, tornadoes, waterspouts, cyclones, as they're called, dust devils. And dust devils can be relatively small, you know, 50 feet, 100 feet tall. Or they can be extremely tall, or like on Mars, they can be, you know, miles tall, as is the case with a waterspout. But isn't it strange you can have a similar situation on a desert where it's perfectly dry and there's just dust, and on the ocean where you have a waterspout out in the middle of no place? I talked about the time when I was on a Caribbean island, and I looked out over the water, and there were two waterspouts, and they were like kind of like swaying back and forth as they moved over the water. There are stories of fishermen who are on a boat, and all of a sudden it just starts raining fish out of the sky. And what happened was a waterspout picked up the fish and literally threw them probably miles away. And then, of course, the unfortunate fisherman is in the path of all of these fish flying out of the air. So very strange phenomenon, but explainable if you understand that what a waterspout is. It's a giant vacuum cleaner. But the point is that if you look at standard meteorology, it talks about cloud systems rubbing together. And you'll find that in the majority of these cases, especially with tornadoes, there are no clouds rubbing together, and nobody has ever even seen this. The idea that somehow clouds rub together to cause swirling motion, etc. But if you look at the actual anatomy of a tornado or a cyclonic storm of any kind, is that first of all, they're rotating. And they're rotating, but the rotation is up the column. It's not just rotating. It's not just wind. In a hurricane, it's not just wind. When you come to the inside of the eye, that material is rising up. And then when it gets to the top of the eye of the hurricane, it spills out over the top and out the sides. And that's what you see. That's the visible part of the hurricane that you see. If you're down below the hurricane, you see what are known as the band clouds. Spiral arms that extend out from the hurricane, and this is on the under layer side of the clouds. But if you've ever experienced a hurricane that makes landfall, what happens is you have a series of tornadoes, and that's a lot of times where the most destruction comes from. So it's raining heavily, and there are tornadoes, F4, F5 tornadoes, and they're the ones that do a tremendous amount of the damage, even though the wind in the hurricane is, you know, 120, 140 miles an hour. A lot of the damage is done by those initial tornadoes. And what are they caused by? They are caused by the hurricane making landfall and the electrical currents, which are driving the hurricane, touching down on land on the leading side of the hurricane and causing tornadoes. So once again, it's the vertical electric field, it's the electrical currents responding to that, and the discharge, which is driving the hurricane. So the what's going on is the electrical discharge is ionizing the air down at the ground level. And then it starts rising up because it's an electric current. the positive charges at the base, and this is along the equatorial regions, is rising up because you have an electron belt going around the equator up in the ionosphere. So those positive free charges are trying to move up in the electric field. They have a clear path because the cloud system that's associated with the storm, this cloud system is sticking up like an electrical finger, making that connection possible. If there were no clouds, there would be no hurricanes. There would be no way for them to start. So you can see these cloud systems coming off of the western coast of Africa, and they are basically rain and electrical storms, lightning. But as soon as they get out over the ocean, that's when they start to form the hurricanes, because it loses the vertical electric field, the electrical connection there that was causing the lightning over land. That electrical connection is no longer completed when the storm moves out over the ocean. So what happens? The ionized air at the surface of the ocean becomes the other side of the capacitor, and it's mobile. It starts to move up the column, and the Coriolis force, the same force that causes the water to swirl in a drain, like when you pull a plug in a tub, especially the old-fashioned plugs. It was just a plug and then a big hole. And all of a sudden, the water starts spiraling. Well, what's the water doing? It's being pulled down by gravity, and it's the swirling force is caused by the rotational, one of the effects of the rotation of Earth. The end result in a hurricane is that the ionized air is moving up the column and it starts spinning. And so that's where the wind comes from. The idea that a hurricane is caused by warm weather is absolutely ludicrous. There's no physics involved. There's no physics that would explain how cooling a warm water basin like the ocean would cause air to rotate and cause high winds and have a rising column of air. There's no physics there. There's no physics that would explain such a ridiculous concept. So the only thing that explains it is the vertical electric field. This storm is driven by electricity, and it just shows you the amount of energy up in that vertical electric field, up in the ionosphere, the amount of stored energy. And that's why when Tesla was doing his work, the Wardenclyffe Tower, Colorado Springs, he was only tapping into a very small portion of the vertical electric field. Okay, now I've talked about tornadoes on the sun, but I haven't really explained them in terms of the physics. And so they are related also to the vertical electric field on Earth. And around the sun, you have the similar situation where you have a non-uniform, but also a vertical electric field that comes off the surface of the sun. Jupiter has the same thing. The Great Red Spot on Jupiter is a cyclonic storm that's driven by the same conditions, a vertical electric field. The air is rising up the column. You can see it's a cyclonic storm. But, of course, in the situation with the Great Red Spot of Jupiter, it does not have landfall. There's no land there to short out the circuit, so it just keeps going and going and going, like the Ever-Ready Bunny. And it's been there since the time of Galileo. Galileo saw it with his little homemade telescope. And, of course, everybody wondered what this spot was on Jupiter. Well, it turns out to be a cyclonic storm. Okay, back to tornadoes on the sun. So the same thing with dust storms or dust devils on Mars. You have a vertical electric field. The air, there's not a complete short circuit to ground. And due to turbulence in the air, etc., these discharges begin. And you can see this, for example, if you have a fire out on the desert, whereas there's a propensity for dust devils, if you have a fire, you will see the fire, it's raising up, and basically what it's doing that hot ionized gas coming off of the fire is like a finger sticking up, and it can start short circuit the vertical electric field, and you'll get a dust devil at the fire. And so when you look at tornadoes, I have dozens, if not hundreds, maybe thousands of photos of tornadoes and vertical spouts, cyclonic storms that have lightning coming up. And you can see them, especially at night or later in the twilight, early in the morning or late at night, right after the sun goes down, in these tornado photos where you see the lightning inside the column of the lightning or inside the column of the water spout. And so the tornadoes on the sun are the same activity, where you have the vertical electric field, the ionization at the surface of the sun. It comes up, and because of the rotation, the Coriolis force, etc., causes it to spin and rise up, and that's where the wind comes from. That's where the tornado. And if you go back to Moses, the big column of basically a tornado leading off into the sky was the discharge from the passing comet Venus, which was hitting the ground, and they were right there. They were observing this firsthand. They talk about the column of fire leading up into the sky, and it was a hurricane. And in that movie, the great movie, The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, I suggest you go look at that, because Hollywood did a tremendous version of that vertical electric field tornado from the comet, and it just stood there. It stood in the desert during the middle of the night, and it separated them from Pharaoh's armies. And then the gravitational wave came and caused the Red Sea to move. They were able to walk across pretty much dry land to get to the other side. And by the time Pharaoh's armies got into the Red Sea, the water came swooshing back and killed them all. This is real history. This is not taught in history books, unfortunately, but it all is related to physics of how this works, and that's why these historical events are so important. Okay, well, a very good show this week, a lot of information. The next shows I'll be talking about what's coming in the future, where's my work going. I'll be talking about other major projects that I have, etc., that are ongoing. But once again, visit my webpages, jmccsci.com and jmccwaterfilters.com. And remember, you can use the coupon code on the water filter page, JMCC. I believe it's a 10% discount. And for any of the water filter products there. Once again, this is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.